widely about the legal aspects of the war on terror. She would be the go-to person to understand those legal dark corners. She, of course, blogs at emptywheel.net and writes a Right to Know column for exposedfacts.org. We're going to put all that info on the KBOA website. This has been Ericast KDF on Monday, October 13th, 2014. Kate Welch engineered the show today. Kathleen Stevenson's the KBOA AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. No rights.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to support More Love for Linda, a tribute and celebration of life for Linda Hornbuckle, who passed away Saturday, October 4th. A benefit concert was already planned to help raise funds for her medical bills, and now will raise funds for the family debt and serve as a public tribute and celebration of Linda's life. More Love for Linda will be held Tuesday, October 14th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Crystal Ballroom and will feature Quarter Flash, Soul Vaccination, the Linda Hornbuckle Band, and other special guests. Again, that's Tuesday, October 14th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Amazing grace.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In his State of the Union address this month, President Obama pleased many environmental activists when he pledged to seriously address the issue of climate change. But hidden within his promises of promoting renewable and sustainable energy development was a pronouncement that the United States has drastically increased domestic drilling for natural gas. What Obama did not mention was that a lot of that natural gas is now extracted using an unconventional, controversial method known as fracking. This morning, we talk about why fracking is not a sustainable solution to our energy needs. My guest is Sandra Steingraber, one of the contributors to the new coffee table tome that we've been featuring on Locus Focus this month, Energy Overdevelopment and the Delusion of Endless Growth. Ecologist, author, and cancer survivor, Sandra is an internationally recognized authority on the environmental links to cancer and human health. A columnist for Orion Magazine, she's currently a scholar in residence in Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York, and she's the author of The Whole Fracking Enchilada in Energy. Welcome to Locus Focus, Sandra.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you start out your article by saying that I have come to believe that extracting natural gas from shale using the newish technique called hydrofracking is the environmental issue of our time, and I think you should think so too. So we just heard a piece a little while ago before on the problems with tar sands extraction and the Keystone XL pipeline, and there's all these environmental problems facing us. So why have you focused in on fracking as like the issue we need to focus on?
Fracking is, of course, one of several forms of extreme energy extraction that we are now actively going after, since all the easy-to-get fossil fuels have pretty much already been gotten and burned through. Fracking, of all of them, tar sands, mountaintop removal, deep sea oil drilling, is the one that unrolls across the landscape where we all live, including very densely populated areas. And so it's the one that uses our land as its factory floor. And there's no zoning. It turns our communities into industrial zones, and we're compelled to live in. So from a public health point of view, especially now that fracking has moved from west to east and is massing at our southern border here in New York, where I live, We're talking about, you know, the third most populous state in the Union with a very densely settled rural area, and now we're going to frack it. So drilling and fracking, onshore drilling and fracking operations will certainly have released a lot of new fossil fuels, and we now have this sort of temporary glut of gas, but these wells deplete very rapidly, and so the only way to keep it going, keep the fossil fuel party going, is to basically transform our whole rural area into a great big gas field. So now we're at a position, and this is new data released by Randy Udall, leasing land for drilling and fracking exploration is now the number one land use in North America. So we now have more land under lease to gas and oil exploration, thanks to fracking, than we have in corn and wheat acreage, for example. And that's pretty stunning, especially since we're on the brink of exporting quite a lot of it, thus becoming a gas extraction colony for the global marketplace.
Well, you refer to natural gas as kind of a Jekyll and Hyde fuel. What do you mean by that? Because natural gas has been promoted as like a clean alternative to coal. So what do you see as the up and the downsides of natural gas?
Well, I no longer see an upside to natural gas, but the old narrative of and it's still out there, has a lot of currency, right? Is that it's a bridge fuel to the future because it burns at the point of that you light a match to it. Natural gas as a fossil, and we have to remember it is a fossil, even though it's a vapor. It's not solid like a lump of coal. But when you light it on fire, you get half of the CO2 that an equivalent amount of coal will produce. However, that kind of very simplistic analysis leaves out the footprint that natural gas has in its extraction process. And when the shale is blown apart in order to free tiny bubbles of methane and they're brought to the surface, it's a very brutal and leaky process. And so the best science shows us that somewhere between 4% and 9% of that methane is lost to the atmosphere in the all the way from the point where the drill bit goes into the ground through its distribution through pipelines and into our homes. With that kind of methane leakage, and of course methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, depending on the time frame you're looking at it, it's somewhere between 20 and 100 times more powerful at trapping heat than a molecule of carbon dioxide. What that means is that natural gas is either at least a big at least as lethal a climate killer as coal, or perhaps even worse. We can argue about how much worse or how, if it's, you know, equivalent, but the point is that it's not a bridge to a clean energy future. It's a terrible distraction because it's become the number one obstacle now to investment in what we know we need to do, which is get off carbon altogether as investment dollars are flowing towards natural gas. So I'm not trying to claim that fracking is somehow worse for us or worse for the climate than the tar sands pipeline. What I am claiming is that it's in that club of very bad fossil fuels that's leading us down a ruinous pathway. And of these very bad fossil fuels, nobody's claiming that tar sands is somehow a green fuel, whereas natural gas is dressed up as something clean and green. So of all of these bad fuels, petroleum, coal, and natural gas is the only one that somehow can fool us thinking that it's green when it's not. And that fooling has hoodwinked several of our large environmental organizations who have in the past taken actual money from the natural gas organizations, but also have paved the way and worked hand in glove with the industry in order to allow fracking to occur.
Are you okay with naming some names? I'd be curious to know who in the environmental community is in bed with the natural gas industry.
I'm very unhappy with Environmental Defense Fund over their stance. And I say that as a former admirer of what Environmental Defense Fund used to be. And it's important to point that out. Environmental Defense Fund was started by a group of very heroic scientists who took up Rachel Carson's torch after her death from breast cancer shortly after Silent Spring was published. They recognized that they were not going to achieve a ban on these unregulatable chlorinated hydrocarbons like DDT and PCBs simply by arguing on the strength of the science. They were going to have to forcefully insert themselves as scientists in the political process, and for that, they needed a legal system. And so they founded Environmental Defense Fund. And that was an organization founded with the belief that there are some technologies so harmful and so unregulatable that no mitigation strategies and no laws can manage or control them and create acceptable risks. And so they simply needed to be abolished. And EDF played a hero's role then in abolishing DDT, and then later played a role, especially one of the founders of EDF, scientist George Woodwell, who's now 85 years old, still a very active scientist. I just emailed him yesterday. In also banning PCBs in 1976. PCBs, by the way, has just been named a known human carcinogen by the International Cancer Organization with the World Health Organization. That announcement will be coming out soon. So that, in other words, the science is finally showing us what some very courageous scientists knew and suspected in the 1970s, which is what we have a sign of emerging harm here. So for Environmental Defense Fund, who started so nobly, to now try to dress up another unmanageable, unmitigatable threat to the planet and to human health as something that they're interested in promoting, I think is very regressive and it belies the wonderful principles that organization was founded on.
Well, it seems to me that most of the environmental community, as far as I can see, has been really opposed to fracking. Though I do see there's also sometimes these hair splittings between, well, fracking is bad, but if you get natural gas from conventional methods, it's okay. So I'm wondering if there's anybody else in the environmental movement who is, anybody else is buying into fracking, and also how that question about fracking versus conventional sources plays out, and if there's any actual reasonability on that argument as well.
Well, the organization that I helped to found, New Yorkers Against Fracking, is openly an abolitionist movement, and that's the conversation I'm really interested in having with all of the big green groups, wherever they are along the spectrum, is to challenge the big environmental organizations, which I think have been asleep at the switch mostly on this issue, to show me the data indicating that this can be done safely. I don't see that there such data exists. And, in fact, the data that we do have indicates that even with the most strict regulations, sooner or later, cement disintegrates, right? And cement is not an immortal substance. And so when you dig a hole a mile deep into the shale, which contains many hazardous substances that you then liberate, essentially, you know, you talk about taking the lid off of Pandora's box, or basically fracking Pandora's box, and releasing not only bubbles of methane, but a lot of other stuff that's down in the shale, including benzene, formaldehyde, radon, radium-226. These things either come up as vapors or come up with the fracking flowback fluid, which then requires disposal somewhere. So what protects our groundwater from all of these naturally occurring toxic chemicals are layers and layers of rock. But, of course, we have to penetrate through them in order to drill, and bisecting our aquifers as we go. So the only thing now that stands in the breach as a boundary, as a barrier between all the nasty stuff in the bedrock and the groundwater aquifers that lie above is now a well casing, which is made out of cement. And so as that well casing shrinks, as it crumbles over time, it's possible to open up pathways, portals of contamination, which allow methane and other vapors to rise up from deep geological strata and enter the bedrock. That's my concern. Maybe with good regulations, it won't happen right away. Maybe it will happen 20 or 30 years out. But surely we owe future generations something better than digging holes in the ground that are basically like laying time bombs in the earth for putting our aquifers at risk. So if that's not the case, then the big green organizations need to show the data, and the industry needs to show the data that this can be done safely. No such demonstration has been made yet. So from that, biologically speaking, I would argue we should not move forward until we have demonstration of safety.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this morning we're talking with Sandra Steingraber, who is the author of a number of books about toxins in the environment, a longtime activist and writer and scientist on the issue, and she's the author of an article in the Coffee Table book called Energy that just came out recently. It's a project of the Foundation for Deep Ecology, and her article is called The Whole Fracking Enchilada, and this morning we're talking about just why fracking is not the solution to our energy future, as was partly alluded to by Obama in his State of the Union address a couple weeks ago. Well, I want to move into movie reviews for a couple moments, Sandra, and talk about the two movies that have brought fracking to the public consciousness in the last few years and some of the issues that you're just talking about with all the toxins that are being trapped by bedrock that we are releasing through the fracking process, which I think has caused some confusion in the public mind about what fracking does and why people have methane in their water supply after there's fracking in the neighborhood, and how easily the gas industry has kind of blown off the arguments. Now, in Josh Fox's documentary from a couple years ago called Gasland, there was some confusion when he was showing these farmers, you know, ranchers in Wyoming setting their tap water on fire, and the argument being that somehow this fracking process had brought this methane into his water supply, and it was an unnatural thing. And I guess Josh Fox came back later and corrected it to say, no, I'm not saying that methane was added to the earth through the process of fracking. It is a naturally occurring chemical in the ground, but fracking has exacerbated the situation. But I wonder if we can talk a little bit about some of the difficulties in defining the science and so that you state things clearly enough that the gas industry doesn't come back and just say that you're obfuscating and exaggerating.
Well, Josh Fox was absolutely spot on correct in what he said. And so the criticisms that he and the blowback he received from the gas industry was kind of based on a sophistry and language play, right? And so and that's because there's people use the word fracking to refer to many different things. And so if we only use the word in its narrowest meaning, which is to say that the moment that we explode the bedrock using water as the club, right, to under very high pressure, you're going to, like, shatter the shale, and that's now called fracturing. The gas industry, by using that definition, is able to say, well, you see, there are no confirmed cases of water contamination from fracturing. However, you don't get fracking all by itself in just those few minutes. Everything else comes along with it, right? And one of the things that comes along with it is actually drilling, and then chemical spills and waste pits full of flowback fluid, and so on. And so the whole process has to then be, you don't get fracking without drilling and without pits and without trucks and without pipelines and compressor stations and condenser stations. And so when we, as I do, use the word fracking as a shorthand to refer to all of those things, then we have actually thousands of cases of water contamination caused by the activities of drilling and fracking operations. And that is where Josh Fox is absolutely correct. Now, the other interesting thing here is that we don't know a lot about what goes on below our feet. There's so many unknowns in geology. And now that I've been studying geology pretty intensely for the last 2 years, I've come to appreciate just what an unmapped and unknown world it is down there. So it looks like two things are going on. One is that we actually do have data now showing that the very deep methane trapped in deep geological strata for 400 and 500 million years, that methane representing the vaporized corpses of sea creatures that lived here long ago, we have found that methane in groundwater after fracking operations, and we know it's that methane because we can fingerprint it, and we know that it's not, you know, naturally occurring methane from surface operations or for something that happened recently. So we know that that has happened. But in other cases, we also know that the actual act of drilling and putting pressure and doing things under the earth has mobilized more shallow pockets of methane that we're not actually going after in terms of drilling, but that has now been pushed or moved in some way underground, has found underground passages and then moved into people's drinking water. So if you are, you know, living in a house and suddenly your water is carbonated, only those bubbles are not carbon dioxide, they're methane bubbles. It looks like you're drinking champagne. And now you could blow up by taking a shower. Now you have this unsafe situation. Do you really care whether that methane is 400-year-old methane from deep geological strata that was actually is what fracking is going after, or that it's more shallow methane that happened to be mobilized into your underground aquifer through the act of drilling and all this attendant activities going on, that you just disturbed this naturally occurring pocket that was more shallow. I don't think it matters. I think it matters that you now have methane in your water and you didn't before, and you're now in a dangerous situation. And if fracking hadn't come to your community, you would not have been in that situation. So that's the kind of hair splitting that we're talking about here, and that the kind of arguments that Josh is receiving, as do I sometimes, from the gas industry.
Well, I recall, actually, that the community that Josh features in Wyoming, I think that there were studies that the EPA did that basically confirmed what the ranchers and what Josh was showing in the movie, that this methane was, in fact, due to fracking. I don't know what the blowback from the gas industry has been since then, but it seems like you are getting confirmation in your assumptions and in some of your initial studies that they're coming from places on high now.
Indeed, and that particular community in Wyoming is Pavilion, Wyoming, and yes, we do have confirmation.
So let's do another movie review now, which I think hits at another issue you're talking about, which has to do with precaution. The movie that Gus Van Sant put out a couple months ago, Promised Land, which I actually was kind of frustrated by the fact that it didn't really confirm in the movie that there are dangers, only that there's the threat of danger. And it seemed like it was being very cautious in not showing what we know already, but just warning that this could be a dangerous process. And mainly it was very critical of the process by which farmers sell their mineral rights. And it was more about that than it was really about the dangers of fracking. And I wonder, is that a sort of an accurate representation of where the argument is at right now in the public sphere, that we really don't know yet, but maybe we should be cautious?
Yeah, I think so. I think Matt Damon was correct when he said that they really wanted to write an American story about the situation that our rural communities are in now, not necessarily write a story about fracking. So fracking is sort of like the backdrop to this drama, right? But the larger way the issue is framed in that film, even though fracking is actually never shown, is, I think, does represent the state of things. We have a large, vast pool of ignorance about the fracking's harm. Some of that is simply because the technology is new and science hasn't caught up with it yet. But some of that is manufactured because of secrecy. This is an industry that wherever it goes is surrounded by secrets. It's exempt from most of our federal environmental laws, which means that the federal government has very little control over it. It doesn't have to follow the rules and the provisions of parts of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, and so forth. So in other words, if you were any other industry and you wanted to pour a carcinogen down a hole in the ground, you couldn't just do that. there are rules about things like that. And at the very least, you'd have to report under right-to-know provisions that say what it is you're pouring down that hole. And there are probably more rules and regulations than that. But because fracking in particular gets a pass on all those rules and regs, then they don't have to tell us what they're using. They don't have to measure emission rates and so forth. So those of us in the public health community who want to do science, who want to say, study the health of people who live close to drilling and fracking operations, we don't know what to look for. So when people show up at their doctor's office and they feel horrible, and it turns out, let's say, they have barium poisoning, not knowing what they're using and what's going on, we don't know always, we don't know, you know, what to measure. We don't know what to say to a physician, well, test them for arsenic poisoning, or they should look for this, because this is what we know that they're using in drilling and fracking operations. And in Pennsylvania, they've taken this secrecy one step further. The industry has compelled the state legislature to pass Act 13, which actually forbids physicians from speaking about what their patients have been exposed to. And it's a deal with the devil. The physicians can request in writing information from the industry about what chemicals they're using in order to treat a patient who suspects they may be sick from all this. But in return, the physician has to sign a non-disclosure agreement, which is really interesting because physicians have as their kind of higher calling not only a duty to do no harm and protect people, but if they suspect that there's a public health problem, to ring the alarm bell. And that sometimes that means going to the media, sometimes it means calling up the public health department and so forth. And so individual physicians, of course, have played a hero's role in all kinds of different environmental health problems. It was physicians who realized in, you know, decades ago in San Francisco that there was a connection between the bathhouses and the apparent transmission of some kind of immune-suppressing problem in the gay male population. And it was by gathering the stories of their gay male patients that they were able to finally identify HIV as the causative agent and so forth. And there, I have many, many stories from my own field of public health about how that works. But the point here is that physicians in Pennsylvania are prohibited from carrying out that part of their duty and responsibility as healthcare providers and as first responders for what could be a public health problem. So with that kind of secrecy in place, then the question becomes, how much information do you want before you say no to this industry? We're not allowed to have the information we need to do the definitive science. And anyway, the science is going to be very slow because we're talking about multiple routes of exposure, both by air and by water and so forth. So it would take us years to get that information. And what do we do in the meantime? I truly believe, as both a scientist and a cancer survivor myself and the mother of a child with asthma, that we have a moral obligation to protect people first while the science goes on, which means saying no.
Well, what you're describing with the secrecy of the gas industry, it kind of reminds me of something I was reading just a few days ago about the tobacco industry back in the 50s and 60s when they were trying to shred evidence that they had that smoking caused cancer, that secondhand smoke caused cancer and other illnesses. And that here they were putting out this product for public consumption and really being pushers for an addictive drug and knowing just how dangerous it was, but wanting to, for their profits, to keep it from the public. And it feels to me that there's a similarity now with the gas industry, the difference being that a person chooses to smoke, but a person doesn't choose to live next to, well, I guess if you're selling your mineral rights to a gas company, then you are choosing in a way. But if your neighbor does it, you have no choice about living next to these fracking operations. Do you see a parallel, and do you see that there may be a possibility of using some of the lessons learned from going after the tobacco industry to go after the gas and oil industry?
The last part of your question is really interesting, and I haven't yet thought about that. But the first one is, there's more than parallels. There's actually it's kind of history repeating itself. And I think Josh Fox, again, has been out front on this. His new documentary short, The Sky is Pink, which anyone can just kind of Google that and find it, The Sky is Pink, not only explicates the parallels, but actually demonstrate that the same public relations firm that was once involved in casting doubt on the evidence that tobacco causes lung cancer is now retained by the gas industry to raise doubts about what it's doing. That being said, I do think there are some larger parallels that are important to make, and secondhand smoke is a good one. I mean, at some point we realized that we had to curtail the right of smokers to smoke in public places because other people's health was being harmed without their consent. And when drilling and fracking operations move into a community, people who have not consented to be exposed to these chemicals are, without their consent, so exposed So there are parallels from secondhand smoke, I think. I mean, each one of these wellheads is like a cigarette in the earth. So all of these toxic gases come flying out of the hole, even prior to, and especially prior to when it's hooked up to a pipeline. And of course, then there are all these kind of attendant technologies, compressor stations, condenser stations, and so on, which also release benzene, formaldehyde, and precursors for ozone, which is smog and is known to be linked to premature aging of lungs and bad pregnancy outcomes and so forth. So we're in a situation now where we actually have emerging evidence showing that pregnancy outcomes are altered among women who live near drilling and fracking operations during their pregnancies. There's some emerging data from Pennsylvania showing that there are lower birth weights and lower Apgar scores, which is a measure of infant responsiveness at birth. But these data haven't yet been published, and it takes a while for it to wend its way through the peer review process. They will be. And usually in the scientific community, we don't talk about unpublished data. You know, except at conferences, people present them and they have poster boards and PowerPoint presentations, and we all argue about what it means and so on. And the only reason I'm talking about it now is to say that these data exist. I talked to their principal investigators. I've looked at the data. They scare me. They're impressive. They will be published. And if we can't, as scientists, talk about them publicly, and yet the industry can keep rolling out this practice that it's kind of imposing on our communities, then we're in a really morally bad situation, because that's what I do. You know, as a professional environmental health scientist, I look at environmental threats to pregnancy and to pediatric development. I've written two books on this topic. So if I have knowledge that children are being harmed, in fact, infants and pregnant women are being harmed, I am morally obligated to say so, like I'm doing right now on your show. And yet, as a scientist, usually we don't talk about unpublished data. So it's a dilemma.
Well, all helped by the shroud of secrecy that we are fighting here.
Right.
Well, I wanted to go back to the beginning in a way and talk about why you are doing this, because, I mean, you were on the show many years ago, right after you published Living Downstream. And in those days, I thought of you as somebody who was very much involved with chemical toxins in the environment and also with watershed issues.
Right.
So now you're into geology and energy, and you set it up pretty quickly in the beginning of this article and in the energy book that your background is not in energy. Your background is environmental toxins. So what has motivated you to make this shift and to be focusing so vehemently on the dangers of fracking?
Yeah, well, here I am standing in the shale, and I'm not coming back. I am now persuaded that the road to chemical reform runs straight through our energy policy. I was moving in that direction anyway as a scientist, as I did research. And you know, readers who know my work will recognize that I've spent a lot of time writing about environmental threats from pesticides, especially endocrine disruptors, and anhydrous ammonia, which is a synthetic fertilizer, which contaminates groundwater and is a reproductive toxicant for pregnant women and so on. I've written a lot about PVC, polyvinyl chloride, as a bad building material, dangerous for us when it's turned into children's toys and shower curtains and car interiors and so on. All of those things come to us from natural gas. So natural gas is the starting point for anhydrous ammonia. It's the starting point for PVC plastic. And the more I looked into all these issues, the more I realized that I thought I was standing upstream when I said toxic chemicals should not be a consumer choice, right? That it shouldn't be up to us busy mothers and fathers to vet every single toy and birthday party goodie bag that comes into our house and have to look at a website every time we want to paint the walls. We need a regulatory system that prevents us from having this stuff circulating in our economy so we can just buy our groceries and go to the hardware store and not worry. That was my message. Well, I wanted to stop these things from being produced at the point of production and invest in green chemistry and green engineering. I still want that. But what I've now recognized is that the chemical industry solves a waste disposal problem for the energy industry. And so a lot of the reason why we have gazillions of plastic bags, which are slathered with, in some cases, phthalates and other plasticizers and fill up our oceans with microscopic bits of plastic that then insinuate themselves into the food chain with these big, you know, garbage patches of ocean. The reason for all that is because ethane comes up with the methane when you frack, and it's a waste product for the energy industry, but it can be, you know, it can be cracked and turned into ethylene and is on its way to being a plastic bag or a farm chemical or something like that. So if we want organic agriculture and sustainable ag, it means that farm chemicals can't be cheaper than farm labor. And as long as we're blasting fossil fuels out of the ground to turn on the lights, we're always going to have these other stuff left over to make stuff out of that's inherently toxic. And so both because I'm increasingly concerned about climate change, which is also a public health threat to our children, and not to future generations, but the generation that my kids are part of, it's the biggest threat to their life. So I feel obligated now to look at the point where these sort of two rivers converge, which is our concern about toxic chemical reform, but also our need for green energy. So that's where I've kind of now planted my flag in my most recent work. Now, would I have gotten there just by pure intellectual curiosity? Probably. But I was also brought there more quickly because I live in upstate New York on top of the Marcellus Shale, and suddenly I was surrounded by land leased to the gas industry. 40% of the land in my county is now so leased. We have a temporary moratorium on fracking in New York, and my intent is to turn that into a permanent ban and to convince our political leaders, in particular Governor Cuomo, that he should keep his promise to be a leader on climate change now that he has witnessed seawater sloshing through the subways of lower Manhattan, and realize that the fire-breathing methane and exhaling dragon known as fracking has no place in New York, and it would be foolish and regressive to build our economy on the pollution prosperity, very temporary, of fracked gas, and instead turn New York State into a progressive incubator for sustainable ideas. That would be the legacy brought to us by a state that had to deal with Love Canal and then PCB contamination in the Hudson River and who had to learn some very painful lessons. So I think we have a shot at this, and so that's where my work is now directed.
Well, I'm thinking, too, there's a big difference in terms of building public awareness when you have the source of energy like underneath the feet where millions and millions of people live. Because, I mean, for many years, more remote parts of the United States have been destroyed by the energy industry, whether
That's right.
it's in Wyoming, where they've been fracking for a long time. I can think of all the uranium mining in New Mexico. I'm thinking about the tar sands operations that are way north above, and then my AAA road atlas, where the tar sands are, is off the map of Alberta, and that's how far up it is. And even with mountaintop removal mining in Appalachia, it's still not a place that a lot of people witness on a regular basis. And it's really different when people in New York City, all the millions of people who live in New York City, whose water supply comes from up closer to where you live. I mean, if you get those people concerned about their health and safety, do you think that this might make it easier to turn around the fracking debate than it has been with the tar sands debate or the mountaintop removal debate?
I don't know if it's easier. I mean, in some ways it's harder, right? Because fracking, natural gas has this narrative surrounding it that it's clean and green. There's no other fossil that has, I mean, nobody says coal or tar sands is clean. I mean, you can argue that maybe it would make jobs or energy security and all those arguments.
What about clean coal?
Can be impeached, right? Well, I mean, I don't even hear clean coal anymore.
I mean, I think that's a dead argument.
I think it's dead. Yeah, everybody knew that was just an oxymoron. But natural gas has this sort of powerful myth about it that makes it makes our job harder. But to your larger point, yes. I mean, we in New York, I mean, 19.5 million people live here. Even our rural areas are densely settled. We are the number two producer of wine, ranked by state. We are the number three producer of organic food. We're the number three dairy state. And so this is the landscape that already has this economy on it, that we're going to now roll out up to 100,000 gas wells, each one of those requiring 9 to 20 acres. And at the same time, we have a city of 8 million people with a very unique water delivery system. There's 1,800 square miles up in the Catskills of surface water, which is entirely, they say it's unfiltered, right? What they mean is that wilderness filters that water. So that it's completely forested and undisturbed, and that water is carried by gravity to the city 100 miles away through 100-year-old tunnels, these two aqueducts that carry all the water from the Catskills down to New York City. They're very fragile, they leak, and they lie right on top of the Marcellus Shale that's fractured and riddled with cracks. And we're going to frack that. How close? And we're going to drive trucks full of fracking chemicals back and forth across the watershed of New York's drinking water. What if one of them overturns? So these are the kind of issues that make New York State, I think, unusual and unique. Besides the fact that our wine-growing region, unlike where I grew up, right, in the cornfields of Illinois, nobody comes to the cornfields of Illinois just to stand in front of the cornfields and stare out at them, even though I actually think they're beautiful. But people do come to the wine-growing region where I live now and go on wine tastings and have, you know, there are many bed and breakfasts, and it's a big tourist destination. So will people come if we fill up the roads with fleets of 18-wheelers hauling hazardous materials? We already see across the lake from where I live, right in the middle of all these vacation cottages and wineries, drill rigs going up. And these are being used to pump methane and butane, these leftover hydrocarbons from the fracking fields of Pennsylvania, into depleted salt caverns under the lake. So building these big gas bombs under the lake. It's very loud. It sounds like a helicopter now. It's hovering over the lake all the time. Lots of diesel. We already had one scary accident between a propane truck on our little back road. And these roads are designated as scenic byways, right? So people come to leaf peep and to drive through. And now we're going to fill them up with the worst kind of traffic, large trucks hauling explosive materials. And so when there's an accident, which there has been between a Subaru and one of these tanker trucks, then the whole highway has to be closed down, right? And all traffic has to stop. So how does this line up? How is this compatible? Of course it's not. But it's the world's biggest industry who believes that they can just have their way with us. Their word for everything between the surface of the earth and what they call the area of economic interest, namely the fossils, the fossil fuels, they call that overburden. We call it our home. So that's the battle. That's where we're lined up, and it's going to be a really big battle, right? We have close to 7,000 people now. I'm one of them who have signed what's called a pledge to resist fracking, meaning that should the governor approve fracking in New York, which he has not done, then we stand ready. We take a solemn vow to engage in acts of peaceful protest and nonviolent demonstration as our conscience leads us, which for many of us will mean civil disobedience. At the same time, we're hoping we never have to enact that pledge. We hope that the power of our signatures alone and our organizing efforts and the science will lead our governor to believe that his future lies with us, and it would be a political liability for him to move forward, because he will know that as soon as anything goes wrong, and there will be something that goes wrong, there will be a child who's killed by a tanker truck, you know, who's riding her bike on the side of the road. There will be an overturned truck that contaminates somebody's well. There will be an explosion, you know, and that he will be accountable for that, because it was his decision. So in that way that New York has of kind of thinking of itself as a forward-thinking state, we have a governor who gave us gay marriage, who's fighting for women's reproductive freedom, who's not afraid to take on the gun lobby. We believe that it would be consistent with his larger philosophy, and also for us as a culture, as New Yorkers, to say it's time now to let our state lead the way and be an incubator for what it would be like to build out our rural areas and provide jobs and on the basis of green energy. You know, why not have our dairy farmers, instead of saying the only way you can keep your farm is to blow it up and put a drill rig in the back 40, why not put a solar array in the back 40 and have each farmer be able to supplement farm income by delivering renewable energy to a smart grid? I mean, that's another choice that we could make. And that's the choice that we're trying to help the governor envision it. We need imagination. And the imagination can come from science, and it also can come from artists, which is why we're very pleased that we have fighting side by side with us scientists some pretty amazing New York artists like Yoko Ono and Salman Rushdie, you know, real visionary people in the world of music, visual art, and belles lettres, to show us a vision for an alternative future.
And you also have community radio on your side.
So. And we do.
Well, Sandra, I would...
And this has been Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein and author Sandra Stein-Grebu talking about fracking. And stay tuned now for Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. And then at 11:30 on the radio zine, host Lisa Loving speaks with Jason Mott, New York Times bestselling writer, NAACP Image Award, and author of the new book, The Wonder of All Things. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Lent's International Farmers Market, a program of Zengu Farm, every Sunday through October at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 to 3. Lent's Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmer Market Club for kids, a community table, cooking demonstrations, and live music. More at lentsfarmersmarket.org.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Dr. Donnie Wilson, is a naturopathic doctor, certified professional midwife, and certified nutrition specialist. She was executive director and president of the New York Association of Naturopathic Doctors for 10 years. And received their award for Naturopathic Doctor of the Year. And she's here today.